our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with Listen, the podcast that highlights the common threads that run through different cultures and unite us as human beings. Today, another conversation in our bundle of interviews focusing on art. We're talking about how to conserve physical artworks for future generations, the role of culture and ethics in this process, and the practicalities of keeping pests at bay. My guest today is Casey Mallinckrodt. As the objects conservator at the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum of Art in Hartford, Connecticut, she oversees a highly diverse collection. The Wadsworth is the oldest continuously operating museum in the United States. She has a master's degree from the UCLA Getty Program in the conservation of archaeological and ethnographic materials and an MFA in sculpture from Yale University. Her primary interest is the stewardship of material cultural heritage and the integration of specific and refined knowledge about the materials with cultural history and practice. Casey Mallinckrodt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kate. I'm so delighted to be joining you today.
Likewise, I'm so glad we could have this conversation. Casey, I wanted to start off with a little bit of context. So I'm just going to ask you straight out, what does an art conservator do?
It's a good question and one that needs some answering. People often get confused. Are we conserving the natural world? But we're not. We're conserving artworks. And although in Europe, the term restorer is often the term of art, the title for our profession. But conservation really involves the long-term preservation of cultural heritage. We do a lot of examination, documentation, analysis. If necessary, we do treatment. We are the ones who get to touch the artwork, which is really exciting. And we emphasize and advocate for preventative care. So we're involved with making sure that storage conditions are right and lighting is right. And conservators publish a lot, and we share our information among our colleagues, and we teach and nurture upcoming conservators. And we may specialize. Say I'm involved with objects generally, and most specifically with cultural heritage or archaeological materials, but there are paintings conservators, people who work specifically with textiles, glass. I may contract with a specialist in something like outdoor sculpture, which we're doing now at the Athenaeum at the Wadsworth, to treat an outdoor bronze sculpture that's become a bit discolored. So it's a lot of oversight and engagement and bringing everybody together.
Yeah, it's much more rich. I mean, I knew that it was that there was a lot there, but I don't think I realized how much there was there. I'm curious how you came to focus on conservation rather than restoration, for example, but also, you know, what drew you to conservation as a person? What was it that made you go down that path?
Well, you know, I worked as an artist for a long time, and I felt though it wasn't, I loved the materials and the objects, but I found I was more committed to the other artwork than to making my own. And I was had the great good fortune of being tumbling into a great mentor, Michelle Marincola, who's a conservator at the Met, who was at the time the conservator at the Cloisters in New York City. And I had a thought, gosh, all I really want to do for the rest of my life is clean objects at the Cloisters. So I, you know, know nothing really about conservation. So I called, and she was, you know, just one of those great guides who explained the field to me. And what really intrigues me is that it's scholarship, hands-on, and scientific, and you have to bring it together, and you have to collaborate with the curators and the art handlers and the building control people. So it's a great field.
And why, just to go back to my question, why conservation rather than restoration? Can you sort can you sort of highlight what the differences are there? Because I hear a lot of similarities, but what are the differences?
Restoration is, certainly in this country, it mm-hmm. indicates that something is being restored to the way it appeared before something else happened to it, okay. as it was originally made. And conservators are committed to conserving the materials, the in some cases, the history of an object, rather than what was the very first iteration of it. Mm. We don't necessarily want to be disguising our work, certainly with ethnographic and archaeological work. You may, with a when I've worked on decorative arts, I don't want a museum visitor to see what I've done if they're closer than, say, 2 feet. Subtle, but in all the documentation, it'll be very clear. You can look at it with ultraviolet light. You know exactly what materials I used, and it's completely reversible. With restoration, it's often get it back to where it was, and that's what the owner or the private collector might want.
They're right. not interesting. So yeah. it sounds like not only are you not trying to cover your tracks when you do your work, you actually want other people to see exactly where your tracks are so that in the future, they'll sort of know what has happened.
Exactly. So well put. We are all about marking our tracks. Mm. We do before, during, and after treatment images. We photograph, do a sort of front, back, side, top, bottom photograph when things come into the museum. So we can really know what's happened over time. If something's been dropped, God forbid, or it's loaned.
Oh, I know. My goodness. Or it makes my skin crawl to hear you say that.
But things happen. Something might be on exhibit and a visitor accidentally falls into it. Something like that. And so we need to know exactly what's happened, and we wanted, there's a very clear code of ethics for conservation, and we try to do everything in such a way that it's reversible, or if not reversible, retreatable. And so someone in the future who has a better method of analysis can come in, reverse what we've done, still get the original information out of it, and then stabilize it again.
Mm-hmm. I heard what you said at the beginning of your answer about how things are a little bit different in Europe and when it comes to the two disciplines of conservation and restoration. And I'm thinking about something that I witnessed here in the town where I live in central Spain that really caught my eye and that I had never seen before. And I'd just like to tell you about it to hear your reaction. So in the old town, there are castle ruins. There's almost nothing left of the castle, but there is sort of the exterior wall. And several years ago, I don't know where the funds came from, probably the European Union, but there was some cash flow coming in and they were able to do some work on this old castle wall. And the way that they did it, along the original line, they laid these stones that showed exactly where the ruin ended, where it looked ruined when they began to work. And then what they created was very smooth and regular at the top. Mm-hmm. But they wanted everyone to know, this is what we've done and this is what we started with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's very characteristic of the way we try to work. And really, right now in Europe and the United States, it's really more of a term difference where restorer versus conservator is used. And it's just a tradition. I don't know why that shift was made in the United States or at what point. But I think because so much restoration had been done that was damaging, that the field wanted to make a very clear break in the early 20th century.
I want to ask you, Casey, about because you've mentioned ethics. That seems like we're going to go into that later. That's sort of the more intangible part of your discipline. But I'd like to start with the physical challenges and what are the biggest physical challenges that you have come up against when it comes to art conservation?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are always we're always working to modify or to mediate the effects of deterioration. And those primarily are light, water, moisture, the effect of heat change on particularly water, and insect pests, which are, mm-hmm. you know, obviously a huge problem. And then humans, who are probably the most damaging component. Mm-hmm. Just because when you, whenever you move something, and in fact, whenever you treat something, you're putting it at risk. And we, so we try to minimize that. But we take, we work very hard to help determine how to control the atmosphere in a museum so that the temperature and relative humidity are stabilized at about 50% relative humidity and about 72 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. And you'll have to translate that to the Celsius because it's not on the tip of my mind. And with some degree
so what are the degrees? 72 Fahrenheit?
Yes.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
So I'd say in Celsius, that's probably about 20.
Yeah, I should know.
Something like that.
I worked in Europe, but I'm forgetting. So.
If you were working there now, I'm sure you'd have it right in the front of your mind.
Another thing that I've been dealing with quite a lot at the museum, and many conservators are, is the nature of the materials that are used in exhibitions and in spaces where art is contained. But it's particularly an issue in contained vitrines because...
So these are like glass showcases, right?
Glass or plexiglass showcases, yes. Often you'll come into a gallery, there'll be a little column with what we call a bonnet, a plexiglass box that sits on top of it, or it's against the wall. The designer will choose materials to put in there that are consistent with the decorative scheme or the design of the installation. But those materials may off-gas something that causes the material, the artwork, to deteriorate. So we use a series of tests to analyze material before it's used. And some organizations are now selling in. We know there are many materials we can use safely. But it's a very interesting process because commercially made materials, the recipes will change because they're proprietary. And so something might be inert 1 year, and then the next year a new additive has been included and all of your silver turns dark within the first month of installation. So there's a lot of collaboration between different artists, different conservators and museums. Mm-hmm. The Metropolitan Museum in New York has a great resource, shared resource that we can go to, but we also test our own materials and make sure that...
How do you sort of organize your time and your efforts when it comes to testing? I mean, are you doing that with every single object and every single show?
No, with every material that might be used in an exhibition. So often the designer will say, we'd like to use this color textile and these are what's available, and we'll get a sample and test it. And that takes about 28 days using a test we call the ADI test. It's an accelerated aging test. You're creating a microclimate, really quite small, a glass sealed sterile glass container in a small laboratory oven, and that's heated to 60 degrees Celsius, about 120 degrees Fahrenheit for a month. And you put the sample in it. You also put strips of very clean copper, lead, and silver, and a little bit of water, so that it's 100% relative humidity, it's a high heat, and you're getting a sense of how an off-gassing material will impact these characteristic materials.
Wow.
And that's it's not absolutely quantitative, but it's something that's really easily repeatable by museums that don't have, say, an extensive scientific analytic method, and we compare results. So
maybe it's not quite as exhaustive, but it gives you what you need.
It lets you know if something can't be used. It's a good way of eliminating things.
I hear you referring to lots of natural materials. Museums are full of natural materials, from textiles, the canvas and paintings, to the wood and the sculptures you work with, and ceramics, other sculptures. You mentioned pest control before, and in fact, I thought it was so funny the way you mentioned it, because you said, of course, pest control is an issue. This is not really something I've ever thought about before. How do you handle that in a museum or a gallery?
Constant vigilance is what it is. And most museums hire an outside pest management company, particularly if they're of a certain size or if they have a restaurant.
Okay.
Those areas have to be treated with commercial pesticides to comply with the law. But there can't be any pesticides used in collections areas, whether it's exhibition space or storage. So we do a lot of...
So none at all? There's no pesticide that's safe?
Unless there's a really major outbreak. And because those are substances that may damage the artwork. So preventative maintenance is really key to making sure that you don't have to apply some pesticide that's going to possibly damage your artwork. I walk through the storage areas and the shared workspaces where artwork would be with our contractor every 2 weeks. We check for tests. I'm the known person you bring a bug to if you find something in the museum. And if it's...
If you can't use pesticides, what do you use? I mean, what do you do?
You keep the place clean and you check a lot. And then...
So it's all about prevention.
Yeah. It's all preventative. If you find... We haven't had anything at the Athenaeum, at the Wadsworth. But when I was working with African materials the prior 3 years, and I know we'll talk about that later, those materials are often, those have a lot of bone and horn and leather and wood that may have been out in an uncontrolled environment and then shipped to a museum at some point. And we did find some insect pests on things that had newly arrived in the museum. And those are treated in a way that solves the problem by removing the oxygen from their immediate environment. So you quarantine them, you put them in an aerobic chamber for a month, and the pests will die.
Well, I definitely want to ask you more about your contact with African art, your experience with African art. We're going to need to take a quick break, but let's come right back and we'll talk about that very subject with Casey Mallinckrodt. We'll be back in just a second.
Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit www.rafsanpedro.es. That's www.rafsanpedro.es.
This is Kate Jetmore with Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Casey Mallinckrodt, here to tell us all about her experience as an art conservator. Let's talk about African art. I'm so excited about this part of the interview. I know you spent several years at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes. Yep.
I read that you were carrying out the technical analysis and conservation of their African collection. That is so exciting. I'd love it if you could talk a bit about that and tell us what some of the projects were that you found most exciting and some of the issues that you found yourself engaged in while you were there.
Yeah. Oh, it was a great project. The Virginia Museum of Fine Arts received a large Andrew W. Mellon Foundation grant to carry out this project. And the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts has an excellent African collection. And the curator, Richard Woodward, the former collection of African art, had done a lot of work in collaboration with the former conservator there that really drew the attention of the Mellon Foundation. And there's a great interest right now in general, and as many of your listeners will know, in really addressing the issues of colonial collections, how they got where they are, should they be there, what's the history that's been stripped from them. And so this project was an opportunity to use observation, technical analysis, and our own experience as conservators and collaboration with the curators and their research to really dig into what these objects are made of and try to pull the stories back together of why they would be the way they are and what's missing in the way they're presented. So we used analytic equipment.
What do you mean by what's missing? Do you mean like what's missing... When they're exhibited, what's missing in order to tell their whole story? Is that what you mean?
Okay. Yes, and it's I'm so used to thinking about it, I forget to really express it. But as almost all African objects have been exhibited in museums, completely stripped down to a single object. The paint may be left on, or some of the oil on it, but almost every object you see in a museum that is an African, from an African cultural community, is part of a much larger production, or kind of a set of objects, a set of activities. A lot of the things that we have, or the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts has, would have had a skirt, a new layer of paint. It would have been anointed with fresh materials, poured libations over it. It would have been part of a dance. And and the process of preparing it for use would have been an extensive one, with very specific people involved for a very specific purpose. And those contextual details have, for the most part, been stripped away from objects when they come to a museum.
So how do you handle that in general? And how did this project tackle that challenge? Given the fact that, you know, if you bring a beautiful wooden bowl that was carved in a village in Africa, if you bring that to a museum, I mean, by definition, it's out of its context. It's, you know, it's been cleaned, probably. I mean, I want to ask you about that as well. But how do you deal with that? I mean, what do you do with all those essential details? How do you give them a home?
It's a very interesting challenge, and something that we did was really analyze the materials. So, for instance, one object I spent a lot of time working on is called a boccio. It's a figure employed by the Vodun in Western Europe, I mean, excuse me, West Africa, in Benin and that area around that. And it's encrusted with this black, thick material, feathers. There are white inclusions. There's textile underneath this. There are threads wrapped around it that are also encrusted.
Things, and all of those things were applied for a reason, right?
Yes. And so my work on that was really to try to figure out what those materials were, what the layers of application were. And I found that there was blood, there were feces, there's laundry bluing, there's blue pigment, there's starch that was probably spat on it. There probably were alcohol libations poured over it that there's no trace of anymore. Soil, there were bottles with one bottle with some ground bone in it. And those we figured out by observation and a lot of analysis. I wanted to step out of that conversation, just sidestep a little bit to say that one of the things that we strive to do is be either non-invasive or minimally invasive in our analysis. So we'll rely as heavily as we can on x-rays and methods of analysis that allow us to see in ultraviolet light, or using x-ray spectroscopy, which is doesn't involve taking a sample. We did also sample to do microscopy and to do peptide sequencing, which we did in collaboration with the Virginia Commonwealth University. CT scanning, which we did with their medical school. But what we were able to really bring out of that is this material knowledge that we found, in some ways new information, information that was consistent with what curators knew about that object, and also information that got us into some very difficult ethical territory. And in fact, this turned out to be animal blood, goat blood, on this object. But human blood is used to anoint these objects. Human bone may be incorporated into them. And and it's true of even the non-personal materials of the self. It's secret. It's privileged knowledge often. It's secret knowledge. And it helps those who have stewardship over an object now to know how to preserve it, to care for it, to exhibit it. But also it it gives us stewardship over information that may not be ours to share. And
so does that mean some of your findings are recorded in documents that will later not accompany the object when it's exhibited publicly?
We don't know. It may be the case, or the decision may not be to exhibit it, or it might be exhibited with a warning, which some museums will add to say this object is usually not seen by. That's not the case of the one I'm talking about, but there are objects that are restricted from women or men seeing them. Mm. And so there might be some notification before you enter a gallery that in the culture of origin, this is a limitation that would be posed on it. But it's why
I love that the beginning of your answer was, I don't know. And then you listed all these options, because you know what? It's messy. It's complicated.
It is.
And I actually took a class in African art history when I was at NYU. I took enough art history classes to earn a minor, even though I wasn't going for that. And I loved that class. And I still remember our teacher talking about this very thing. She was talking about objects that have, I don't even remember how to pronounce it, patina or patina.
Mm-hmm. Patina.
Okay, they have a patina on them, which is what you've just described. It's a layer or layers of various substances. And in our Western society, this is how it was presented in the early 90s when I was in school. And I remember her saying, we don't know. We're struggling with what to do with this. Mm-hmm. In the past, in our Western society, we looked at something like that and we thought, this is dirty. This is ugly. It's been sullied. But we're going to wipe it all off and shine it all up and put it on a pedestal with a pretty light. And now it looks nice.
Mm-hmm.
But that's 80% of the object's identity and worth that you've now flushed down the drain. So I'm so grateful to you that I'm grateful to hear you talking about the struggle, you know, the unknown and that wrestling that we all need to do.
Well, and it's very much in the mind of conservators and curators now to be more respectful, to incorporate the voice of the community of origin. And we tried, we were able to bring in some members of the communities from which objects had come to help us understand what we were looking at from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very important, but it is more difficult to do, say, than it is with Native American communities, where that's easy, but a lot of work has been done and we're all in the same continent. We found, say, for instance, one of my curatorial colleagues is Nigerian, and he went back to that region in Benin and Nigeria to do some research for our project and was working with a community to discuss an object that I had been partnering with him to study. And we were very interested. It has hidden materials in it that have been, pockets have been carved out and filled and covered very carefully. And he wanted to speak with people in the community to discuss this with them. And there was a tremendous resistance because since that was made, the belief systems have shifted. And there was a real sense of risk that if they talked about it, they would lose some stature in their community because they would be talking about ritual practices that would assign them as being either old-fashioned or counter to the church. So.
Right. You know what I hear in that too, Casey? It makes me think about what's going on as we grapple with Confederate monuments.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, it is a part of our history. It's a part of our history that we can't deny and causes shame and is very confusing.
It is.
And, so I'm not going to pretend that I have any answers, but that's what your statement made me think about. I mean, it happened, right? It happened.
Yes, it did. And this object that I'm speaking about that was from Nigeria wasn't fraught with a kind of shame or abuse that mm-hmm. the Confederate monuments are. It mm-hmm. was just, but it represents that conflict of time and power right. in a community. The Confederate monuments bring up a very different issue, many of them, and I feel very strongly about it, but I won't go into that. But certainly conservators are called on to treat these objects, whether it's in the process of removing graffiti or the process of removing them from where they are. Mm-hmm. And it's something that when I was in Virginia, when there was the unrest in Charlottesville, that the conversation of monuments, Confederate monuments, really was brought to the surface. Mm-hmm. It leveled out, and in the last month, as you've mentioned, it's really come right. back up again with a sense that we cannot compromise anymore. Mm-hmm. And at the time, but both then and now, conservators are talking about the ethics of our profession, and if we are asked to remove graffiti from a sculpture, are we being asked to remove something that's maybe a message, it's something that's relevant to this time in history? So yes, this is where the ethics get in the weeds. It's challenging.
And you know what? When we talk about, we're so far removed from a little village in Benin that is anointing yeah. a statue with oil, right? It sounds so sort of romantic yeah. and otherworldly, but graffiti on a statue in downtown Charlottesville is exactly that. It's yep. a layer that's put on after the object was created that mm-hmm. reflects something at a point in our history.
Mm-hmm.
Such an interesting question.
It is. And conservators have been, you know, sort of called out by people passing by. This is not at this point in history, but previously, for they were being paid, or because they were government employees and the statue was owned by the state or the city, been called out for treating the sculptures that are in conflict with that individual's belief system. And
right.
The conservator ends up being sort of on a front line without being the one to make that decision.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it comes down to, in the end, it's a very personal call, very personal decision.
Yes, I think so. And it's helpful when the larger decisions are in alignment with our ethics mm-hmm. as well. I mean, and you can't step back and say, you know, no, I can't do that.
So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We need to take another short break, but we will be right back to continue our conversation with Casey Mallinckrodt. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. Let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. I'm also hoping you'll subscribe to our podcast. When you rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps to widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. You can find us on social media and check out our blog on our website at thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Casey Mallinckrodt about her interest in material cultural heritage. Casey, I know you've spent some time working with Native American pottery, and I'd love it if you could talk a little bit about that experience.
Absolutely. It was a terrific experience. I was at the Museums of New Mexico and was a conservator on a project to carry out the conservation of some of the archaeological pots. From the early 20th century on, all of the archaeological digs that were done in the state of New Mexico were required to give what materials they acquired to a small set of museums, and among them was the Museum of New Mexico at the time. So there's an extraordinary collection. Unfortunately, over the century since then, a lot of those pots that were part of that were reconstructed with faulty adhesives, but even more problematic, they were filled and completely repainted. So say a funerary bowl that among some cultures, as part of the funerary practice was to punch a breathing hole in the bottom of the pot and place mm-hmm. it over the face of the deceased before mm-hmm. burial. And those pots were removed, were excavated, along, unfortunately, with human remains, and the pot fixed up and repainted by someone at some point.
So that hole that had been intentionally made was sort of patched up.
Wow. Yeah, it was. Yes, thank you for clarifying. It was patched up and repainted. And one particularly notable example, someone wrote their PhD thesis on some of these pots and included one that in which the imagery had actually been created by someone just restoring the pot, making up what they thought should go there, not based on a knowledge of the culture. Mm-hmm. So it's a good example of how why we avoid the term restoration. Actually, going back to that question, we don't want to remove, we don't want to reinterpret, we want to preserve what's there. But part of what was so fantastic about this particular project, which was organized by Landis Smith, who's a conservator in New Mexico, was that the pots were divided or designated in groups according to their ancestral community. And before we would approach each group, we would invite in, or I really should say Landis would, but I was working with her, invite in members of that community, who living community, who were potters, community leaders, interested. And we would spend 2 days with them and really employ techniques that have been, or methods that have been developed in the museum world and Native American community around collaboration between museums and Native communities. And we would start with a meal. We would give them time to just be in storage by themselves. For them, and really the bottom line is to let your, not just consultants, your collaborators be collaborators, but let them drive the conversation. And so we learned so much from hearing how people made pots, that was their grandmother who made that pot, that, this looks as though it was put together in an odd way, but also to share with them what we felt we should do as conservators, what our ethical guidelines were, which is to not rebuild the pot completely, not to put any fills in unless we needed them to hold it together,
right.
Not to repaint, but to remove everything. And in some instances, it was a learning process because some of the community members felt, well, we would like this to look as good as possible, not like a broken piece of pottery. Whereas the conservation curatorial point of view is we want what was really there in the beginning to be highlighted, not to have anything added to it that's not original. So it was just a really rich set of dialogues. And we did that for several communities. And so as part of that, I got to learn about each pottery type, how the clays differed, how the glazes differed, how at one point, the Spanish in New Mexico made it illegal for the native communities to have bullets. And so they, because of that, they no longer had lead to make lead glazes. So there are all of these really interesting details about culture and control that are tied up into the artwork.
Wow. And I'm interested also in, when we talk about Native Americans, I mean, obviously that is all over what's now the United States. So when we're talking about ceramics, which involves mixing earth and other substances, did you run up against or did you discover all kinds of different colors depending on where the earth came from?
Yes, all over. And very interesting how methods were or were not exchanged over fairly short periods of, over very short distances.
Uh-huh.
But also many communities had an identifiable style, or they had a type of utility pot that was what they were comfortable using, and they had developed it because of that, presumably. Although I'm not a specialist in that, so I'm speaking a little out of turn.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I wanted to add, I think, is a very important comment, particularly having mentioned that that Native American funerary materials and human remains were removed. The United States enacted the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act in 1990. And this required all museums in the United States that received or had received federal funding to repatriate funerary objects and human remains. And
specifically
so
for the Native American community?
Pardon me? I'm sorry. I didn't
specifically
hear you.
For Native Americans. Is
yes.
that what you're saying? Okay.
Yes. It's the Native Americans' graves because so many were looted and so many were just dissembled as part of excavation projects. And many bodies, you know, and bones, skeletons were taken.
So what does that mean for these collections all over the world?
Well, it's really restricted to the United States, NAGPRA is. Okay. Other countries do handle it differently.
And what is it exactly that they're repatriating? Is it just the human remains? Is it also...
It's all funerary materials. So lots and lots of other objects that are related, that are community, that were held
by the community. So anything that came from a Native American grave needs to be returned to the Native American people.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's been
intense.
It's very intense. I worked one summer when I was in graduate school at the Arizona State Museum, and they've been very active in developing and carrying out the NAGPRA protocols. They had started this before it was required legally. And I was able to participate in that to some extent and hear the stories of what had happened and how in many cases they had went to a lot of trouble to repackage things in a way that was the most respectful, that protected them. And then many Native American communities came back to them and said, you know, we really just want this in a brown paper bag because it's going right back into the earth. We want to have a ceremony, pull the bottom out and let it go. And this was pots that were, you know, featured in collections or had been very carefully reconstructed. But it's very satisfying to know that that work is being done.
It is. And it's satisfying. It's also very inspiring. And it gives me a lot of hope, especially against the backdrop of what we're all witnessing right now. Less than a month ago, George Floyd was killed by a police officer in Minneapolis. There have been hundreds, thousands of protests and vigils and gatherings. And I was going to say, to do what? What are we doing? I think ideally what we're doing is we're, especially as white people, I am white, you are white. I think ideally what we're doing is we are listening. We are saying, and this is what you just said, they said, here's what we need. And the instinct of these institutions was, you know, it has to be beautiful. It has to be, you know, this is what it'll look, this is a more dignified way of returning. But you know what? They said what they needed, and I'm going to guess that's what they got after that. And you know, sometimes what we think other people need isn't what they need. We need to ask them what they need and then give them what they need.
This is a huge question with, or an issue with African art that's been removed, part of colonial collections. For years, the holding museums in Europe and the United States have said, you don't have the capacity to care for your own work, so we can't repatriate it. So this is a very exciting time, though, because those things are really being turned over. And I think this is for the work on African collections, or even, say, the Museum of the Wadsworth Athenaeum, where I'm working, we have minimal collections of African art and a little Native American. It's not the focus. It's really an encyclopedic and, in some cases, eccentric museum, because it's has been in sort of the heart of New England for so long. But there are a lot of stories that are attached to each of those things, the way, you know, that are attached to people's lives and that carry forward the history of what happened in New England and relating to Native American populations and to American and British conflicts.
You know, in Spanish, there's only one word that translates into two words in English, and the word is historia. So this word in English can mean history or story. Most of my work is as a translator, and I'm always having to find the context when that word pops up. Are they trying to say story or are they trying to say history? And you just said it so beautifully, because history is stories. That's what history is. It's just a quilt of people's intertwined stories. And it sounds like what you have decided to dedicate your life to is giving voice to those stories.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And giving them, in fact, giving more of the, you know, more information to that voice, more, and making sure that it stays around as long as possible for more people to know about it.
You know, I have no doubt that there are listeners out there who may have their interest piqued as a result of this conversation. Are there any websites that you'd like to provide here for people who are interested in knowing more about art conservation, who may be interested also in being in touch with you? And we'll be sure to put that information on our website as well.
Absolutely. For people who are interested in learning more about conservation, they can visit the American Institute for Conservation site, which is culturalheritage.org. People can reach me at my website, which is caseymalincrot.com, and my name is spelled C-A-S-E-Y, then no period, M-A-L-L-I-N-C-K-R-O-D-T.com. And the museum I work at now, the Wadsworth Athenaeum, can be found at thewadsworth.org.
Okay, great. And I'm just going to apologize for mispronouncing the name of the museum at the top of the show. I think I said Athenaeum, but it sounds like it's Athenaeum.
It is Athenaeum, but I think it's variable depending on where in the world you are.
Okay. All right, I'll forgive myself for that then. You know, going back to what I said before about where we find ourselves right now, in Spain, kind of at the tail, at least, of the first wave of this pandemic. In the United States, very much still in the thick of it. And now we're really grappling with some overdue issues when it comes to race in race and culture in the United States and throughout the world. So really, I mean, everything is just, it's like we've thrown everything up in the air and we don't know where things are going to land. What does that look like for an art conservator? What does that look like for a fine arts museum? How will we gather in the future? Will we be able to gather in person? Will it always be virtually, or at least for the near future? And how will we create together? I mean, we're talking about art. How are you handling this at the Wadsworth?
Well, it is an ongoing question, and by no means have all those questions been answered. But we will not be have visitors in the museum until probably late October at the earliest. Mm-hmm. All of the staff has been working remotely since mid-March, so I haven't been able to get my hands on any objects since then. Mm-hmm. We'll be going back to work in early July, as many museums are, but not at full capacity. But what we're really working on is emphasizing electronic media and ways for people to visit the museum remotely. And this will turn into gallery tours, tours with conservators, also more material on our treatments. So we'll be able to bring visitors into the conservation studio and show them what we're working on a more regular basis, which is very exciting.
It is.
And the museums are trying to rise to this question of diversity as well. And this is, as you know, the museum world, art world, tends to be quite white and quite elite because it's an expensive education. It's something that the American Institute for Conservation has been dealing with very directly for about 5 or 6 years, increasing funding to bring students who don't have a wealth of financial resources into the field of conservation, because to even apply to graduate school for conservation, you have to have worked or interned in a museum for well over 100 hours. And
wow.
In the past, and in many situations still, museums haven't had or designated money for that, and they haven't had it. They've relied on interns but not paid them. Mm-hmm. And there's a tremendous push now to make those funds available so that people of a much broader background can get the background experience they need to apply to graduate school.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
I'm very
good
proud
news.
Of the UCLA Getty program. It's been very much on the forefront of that.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, Casey, thank you so much for joining me today. I have really enjoyed catching up with you, and I just want to wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you, Kate. I wish you and your family well. Thank you so much for speaking with me. It has been a real pleasure.
Next time on Listen, we'll be joined by artist Derek Melander as we wrap up our series on art. Hope you can join us. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, where the Baroque facade of the ancient seminary dates to 1748. Check out our archives at thelistenpodcast.com. There are 7 full seasons waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. Lauren Lovett is our producer. Caitlin Fisher handles our social media, and Lidia Munoz Solera writes our blog. Editing, tech support, and original music are courtesy of Lucas Munoz Jetmore. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is Listen.